Welcome to the Voice of Florida Architecture. I'm your host, Rhonda Hammond, AIA. As we've discussed in previous episodes, the primary objective of this podcast is to educate and elevate the public understanding of the role architects play in shaping our built environment. Architects contribute significantly to the quality, safety, and sustainability of the spaces we live, work, play, and gather. This platform seeks to promote an awareness of the profession's value, not only to the public, but also to government officials, policymakers, and our peers. By showcasing the breadth of architects' impact on lives, the podcast also aims to foster appreciation for the profession and to encourage greater engagement with the architectural community, including those not yet affiliated with AIA. AIA Florida has a strategic partner in this mission, the Florida Foundation for Architecture. Their mission is to promote the value of architecture to the public. With us today is the Foundation's Chair, 2025 Chair, excuse me there, Mr. Stephen J. Ruby, AIA. Good morning, Stephen, and thank you for being with us today.
Well, good morning, Rhonda. It's always a pleasure to sit and have a conversation with you and your guests.
To announce a collaboration between AIA Florida and the Florida Foundation for Architecture in the form of an annual podcast series we've entitled Architecture and You. It showcases the value proposition of architecture. Now, Steve, I'm excited for the possibilities that this series can bring. Please introduce the intention for the series.
Well, thank you, Rhonda. I'm too very excited about this series as we've discussed it for several months and as being the inaugural episode, I'm very excited. We at Florida Foundation for Architects are so pleased to be joining you on your mission for promoting our profession. Our vision for this series is to explore with our viewers the spaces we live in, the spaces we work in, play in, and maybe even dream about. We will be diving into a topic that affects us all, but in so many ways, but we don't often realize how it does affect us. And that is the value of architecture in our everyday lives. When we think about architecture, we might picture a famous building or an eye-catching design, but architecture is so much more than that. It shapes our communities, influences how we feel about space that we live and work in, and helps us realize that the architects really solve world problems, real world problems, from housing to climate change to safety and public health. Architects don't just design buildings, they imagine better ways for us to live in the world. Whether it's a local library, a hospital, a school, a park, or even your own home, there's a lot of thought and care and skill behind every design to make those spaces real. In our inaugural episode, we will be exploring an example of why architecture matters, what architects really do, and how good design can improve our lives in ways we may not have ever had imagined. So today we are so pleased to be having a conversation with Joyce Owens, FAIA and RIBA, great credentials. Joyce is the founding principal of Architecture Joyce Owens and is the first woman to receive the AIA Florida Gold Medal. And this is the highest award AIA Florida bestows on one of its members. In 2020, she also received the AIA Florida Medal of Honor for Design. Joyce has also been elected to the prestigious AIA College of Fellows in 2018. And this is the highest honor AIA National bestows on one of its members in recognition for exemplary work in art in contributions to architecture and society in general. Joyce left her London-based practice after 15 years and relocated in Florida in 2004. Both her UK practice and now her Florida firm have received international publicity and numerous awards for her work, which is environmentally and regionally sensitive, as well as culturally appropriate to its place. In Southwest Florida, Joyce has become known as the coastal architect. We'll hear a little bit more about why that's true from her as we talk. She is a huge advocate of climate-sensitive architectural style called the tropical modern. Welcome, Joyce.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, especially on the inaugural podcast. What an honor.
Well, Joyce, someone I just mentioned you being designated as a coastal architect. You know, you got that reputation, and I've heard it and seen it in print many times. Why is that so?
Well, I think it's something that stuck after a few hurricanes. And the reason it was sort of given to me, this name, is because when I came back from England and I started working in Southwest Florida, I immediately was confronted with the first hurricane, which was Hurricane Charlie. And instead of being allowed, I was working with another company. I didn't have my own firm yet. I was working for another company. And I had to learn about hurricanes because Hurricane Charlie did some pretty devastating work on South Seas Plantation, Sanibel Captiva. And so instead of doing, I was asked to be their senior designer in this, one of the largest local firms. Instead, I ended up doing a lot of going out and surveying what the disaster from Hurricane Charlie. And I was a little bit kind of shocked at first, like, oh my God, is this my life? That this is what I'm going to be doing, is like assessing buildings when I really wanted to be off designing like museums and churches. And I mean, this company let me do a lot of nice things, but that wasn't the need at the moment. Our community needed it, all hands on deck, to go out and to look at the devastation by Hurricane Charlie. And so I spent probably about 8 months just doing that work. And it was amazing. I did 71 permits in about 3 months. And I did all the assessments, got out there and put all these permits together with a team of people. And not only did I learn about what a hurricane can do, I learned also about how not to build. So a lot of the buildings in our area were built in the, let's say, 70s, 80s, 90s, and they were all built to standards from those builders that were coming from the north and coming down here and thought they could build in Florida with the same techniques, because there weren't any architects at the time. There weren't a whole lot of builders at the time here. And so they were just using the knowledge that they had from the past. So when we got out there, we saw so many things that had gone wrong. And, you know, like the humidity they hadn't thought about, as well as the salt air, you know, the wind, all the things that a hurricane or a harsh climate like Florida can bestow on a building were sort of ripped away. And you, all of a sudden, you could see all of the bad building techniques. And so it was our job to put the buildings back together in a better way. A great example of that would be like vinyl siding. A lot of the buildings had begun to rot over the years, let's say after 30 years. So the builders went in and they put in vinyl sidings to help stop the rot. Well, that was exactly the wrong thing to do, because it just traps moisture behind behind the vinyl siding. And so all these walls just, by the time Hurricane Charlie came, ripped off that siding, all of these buildings were just, they were full of mold and mildew and so on. And so I really learned a lot about that. So going forward, as I went and I started my own practice after a few years, and the work that I began to get was there was a real need on the islands, on Sanibel and Captiva, along the coast of the west coast of Florida, was to start doing residential work on the coast. And so I started doing some of the first coastal residences after the recession. So nobody had really built new since that time. And so I got to do that. So together with my engineer, we began to look at methods of how we could make these buildings stronger than the ones that had been built recently in the past or in the last 20, 30 years, which didn't which weren't faring very well anyway. They were starting to mold and stuff. I mean, we hadn't had any hurricanes, so you couldn't really tell, but they just weren't very good buildings. And so we just, I had this opportunity then to learn about this stuff and to put it put some practices and ideas together. So what that meant, I'm going to share a photo with you, okay, is that when, after a few years, our buildings were being built, and then we were hit by Hurricane Ian. And so I'm just going to share a couple photos with you. Sort of, this is what happened on the right to a lot of those big homes that had been built 30 years before. They were wood construction, and they just didn't make it through the storm. And then the picture on the left is actually a house that we were had designed. It was under construction, and it made it through the storm because of the new ideas that we were using as to how to make these buildings stronger. So even though this building is not finished, you can see it's under construction here. You can see what happened as you go down the coast. I mean, there was so much damage and so much destruction along the coast of, this is Sanibel Island. And so this home, it was white and it was a big kind of modern home. And it became a bit of a beacon, not only for people that were driving along West Coast Drive, but most interestingly for boats along that were going up and down. Remember, we didn't have a causeway for a while. Our causeway was taken out. And so a lot of people were using boats to get to their properties. And so there just wasn't much to identify anything anymore. So this home that was still standing, it became a beacon for the boaters. So it was almost like a secondary lighthouse. And so this image became very well known around the state, and AIA Florida eventually used it in one of their magazines where they talked a lot about resiliency. And so they decided that because this photograph had gotten so much attention, they used it on the cover of their building. So I just want to, if that's okay, can I keep talking about this idea?
So Joyce, absolutely. Every time I see this image, I ask the question, why did your building stand and everything within eyesight is kind of leveled out into heaps of rubble like you're showing here?
Yeah.
What made your house stand when the others didn't?
So this was a more commercial method that we were using to design our homes, which no one had really done before on the coast. And so oftentimes buildings in the past, I always like to use the visual of buildings were, when you're building above flood, architects and builders had been using pilings, and they raised their buildings above the ground on pilings. And originally those pilings were wood, that was the material we had available. After a while, they realized wood was going to rot, so they started using concrete. So the problem that I struggled with wood and concrete pilings were you can never drive them straight. And so if your foundations, which the pilings are the foundations of the building, even though they're exposed above grade because you see them, they won't be straight and true. And so if your foundations aren't straight and true, then your home can never be straight and true to begin with. So you're always starting with something that's subpar. And so we have this idea of putting our pilings below grade, which I'd like to show you some images about how we do that. And so instead of the pilings coming up like this and holding a house on top, we're going down deep into the ground. And I always use this idea of like the tree roots that hold the building in the ground. And it's almost like the mangroves that are growing on these islands. They're rooting themselves into the earth to hold them straight and true. So this is another photograph of that same building. This is a couple weeks. This is after we were probably about 2 months later when they were starting to clear things. And you can see just how bad this hurricane was and how this building sat all by itself on the beach. And you can see sort of where it was headed. And this is an image of it finished. I just wanted just to see that it didn't stay like this forever. Okay. Like that. So there's been a lot of landscaping come in and so on. But one of the things I want to talk about in this home is that It's this home is actually built above flood, and you can't really tell from this image that it is a home built above flood because we didn't use piling, so to speak, above grade. We used piling.
Joyce, excuse me, what do you mean by above flood?
Well, let's look at another diagram. Here we go. Here's a
Okay.
diagram that explains exactly what I'm trying to talk about. So this is a different home, but it gives you the idea of what I'm trying to say. The blue line indicates water, okay? So according to FEMA, we're not allowed to build livable spaces in this area, which has been, this has been before, even before it was regulated, a lot of people were designing homes this way to let the water flow underneath. So when I, so the livable space, you can see on the two floors above, you have people walking up there. So that's where your rooms are, your living room, your kitchen, your bedroom, and so on, are on those floors. But it, but what FEMA is has asked us to do since the regulations came in place is to raise these buildings above flood so that when a surge or a big wave comes, you're safe from the water, the surge water that comes through. So also in this diagram, you can see the pilings that I talked about. So these pilings are driven below the ground, and then you see these pile caps at the top of these, every group of three that you see a small rectangle. Those tie these pilings together and create a foundation not dissimilar to a strip foundation and these buildings. And then we build on top of them. However, we don't just build regular, I'm going to go to this slide now. We don't just build like a regular house up north on foundations. We actually build what we call shear walls. And the walls that you see in orange here are called shear walls. And those walls are tied into the foundations and they only go in one direction. And that direction is perpendicular to the beach. So it's always perpendicular to the beach so that when the water comes through, which is indicated by the arrows, they can, the water can go straight through the building. So anything perpendicular to the beach is shear wall, and the shear wall means it's holding up the building above it. And then you'll see right at the tip of like the top arrow, there is a wall there. That's what we call a sacrificial wall. So they're called breakaway walls, and when that water hits it, it will break away. And the water will just keep on flowing. So this concept of building above flood in this way is very much stronger than trying to build with pilings because you can see here when I go back, you can see this construction pretty easily here. This is a piling construction on the left where there's a piling with a wood floor above it. And you can see when the wind blows, it's able to move. That building can move. First, it's not straight. It can never be straight and true because they're just not that accurate at driving pilings. But then when the wind blows, the house can actually move back and forth. When you see what I'm doing here on the right, this type of construction where the pilings are down here below grade with a grade beam and then a masonry wall that's almost solid concrete is built in parallel, or sorry, in perpendicular with the beach, then the water can come in and go parallel and come in between these foundations. So, does that make sense?
Sure. Absolutely. So, Joyce, when you it was this the first house that you were able to witness that these ideas worked and worked well?
This is absolutely the first house. This is not the first one. We had actually done, I think we'd done four. This was the fourth one, the one that I showed you before. We had four. One was finished. Sorry, two were finished and two were under construction that had done this. So, of the four houses we were building, not one of them suffered any structural damage. And so, that to answer your question at the beginning, Steve, that's when the name Coastal Architect sort of came out of the woodwork and stuck because all of a sudden we realized not only were we dealing with all the complexities of the foundations, but also the permitting that's required to build on the beach. There's special, you know, on Sanibel, there's certain requirements about light and angle of light, height, lighting, artificial lighting, turtle glass, turtles. I mean, there's so many things that are involved with designing for the beach. And once you've been through a couple of hurricanes, you really learn a lot about what works and what doesn't work. And building on the coast is sort of ground zero. It's the worst case scenario because you've got everything. You've got hurricanes, you've got the salt air at its most intense, you've got the humidity, and you've got the heat as well. So that's ground zero. So everything that we learn about building on the beach, and then we can translate to all of the buildings we're doing on the inland as well. So all the commercial work and all of the residential houses that we do inland are also, we're also learning about which materials work and what doesn't work. And then we can use that knowledge in this climate, because I always feel we have to be incredibly responsible about the place where we're building. So a good architect is always a good architect because they will understand, they have to understand the place where they are designing for. They can't just come in and say, I'm going to design a house, a New England house on the coast of the coast of Southwest Florida, on the Gulf of Mexico. It doesn't work like that. There are so many other considerations that you have to think about while you're designing. So I got a couple more photos about this idea that I think really help. This is a really nice photo to show you how in 3D those orange walls are still the shear walls that are holding up the building. And so I think I can explain it another way. It's like when you think about pilings coming up like this, right? It's like this is the piling and you put the floor on it. That becomes like a table, okay? And if you don't have any cross bracing in a table, it's going to move. It's going to be able to go like this. It's going to rack. Okay. So we call that lateral strength. And if you don't have the lateral strength that you need, that table eventually is going to collapse on you. And so the same things happen with pilings in a building. So when we use shear walls, all of a sudden these walls are so strong, and then we put a concrete plank on top of them. There's no ability for these buildings to rack like this anymore. They're stuck, they're solid. And that's one of the reasons that when the water did go through, in this instance, you can really see what it is that how these buildings were designed to let the water go through. So
Joyce, one of the things that you that every time we have this conversation that I have to smile about because what you're doing is not fighting with nature, but you're letting nature have its way with you in such a way that you can coexist with it.
correct.
Do you find that, how do you communicate that to your clients or to the user of those houses? Is it difficult?
No, I pretty much say exactly what you say, Steve. I say I'm designing with Mother Nature, not against her. And that's something, I always try to explain exactly what I've just said here to my clients before I even start building so that they understand the thought and the consideration that goes into designing in Southwest Florida, where we have this heat and humidity and this really harsh climate. So, and these crazy hurricanes which keep hitting us down here. So yeah, so I try to warn them ahead of time that I typically try to say that their buildings, I used to say, are going to last like they're going to be like the Roman ruins. They're going to last, a couple thousand years. But I've realized now that our concrete that we use to put the mortar that we're using isn't quite as strong, and the concrete isn't quite as strong as the Romans did. They had a better recipe than us. So now I just say that we're going to last a millennium. Okay. So I'm giving these houses 1,000 years. How's that?
We'll take that, Joyce. I'd like to move on to another subject that I know you're very fond of and dear to. I know you have a great fondness for mid-century residential architecture. I know there's a resurgence in interest in that architecture by generations of people who weren't even born at the time these homes were built. First of all, can you explain what mid-century modern residential architecture is? And then why do you suppose these younger generations are fascinated by it? It's become popular. Is it style? Is it functionality? Is it nostalgia for a different time? What makes them special?
Gosh, there's so many things about mid-century that have like sort of brought it to people's mind. I suppose it's just like, the 1920s buildings or older buildings that we see up in New England and so on have become a bit nostalgic. It's because, people started to grow up with them. So my generation, I grew up with looking at these buildings and seeing all of these different styles and opportunities that were new and very, very different to architecture in America. It started in Europe, I feel, and then it came to us. And then we, as Americans, made our own interpretation of this design. And so, what I love about mid-century is it's such a holistic idea because it wasn't just architecture that we're talking about, it was completely permeated throughout our culture. So it was fashion, it was in furniture, it was in product design, automobiles, graphics, interiors. I mean, not just architecture, it was everything all at once. And I think that was a very exciting time. And, we all, who doesn't love to watch Mad Men? I mean, we're not just watching it for Jon Hamm, right? We're watching it because of all the, it's like a visual feast. If you're interested in the arts, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that, right? As to sit and watch that kind of thing. So I personally became fascinated with mid-century. I mean, I've always been interested. But the thing I think that pushed me a bit was when I came back from England, I realized that here in Florida, I feel like everything had been a bit derailed as far as design went. And all of a sudden we were stuck in this kind of what everybody called Mediterranean architecture. And Mediterranean architecture in Florida, it's not, I mean, that Mediterranean architecture doesn't even exist in Italy, okay, or in the Mediterranean. It's something we made up. And so, like, everything was painted beige here. So I called it sort of beige, beige, or beige. And I was mortified. And so I knew that there had to be a way forward. And so, to like get our, to get the community to understand there once was good style here in our state, and I wanted everyone to appreciate what we had in the past, because from the beginning our buildings have always been very climate sensitive. The Cheeky Hut, for example, it was just shade raised above ground, and it was all about ventilation. And then there was next, like some of the farmhouses and so on, which became like cracker style, right? Where everything was again raised above ground. It was very simple idea. Let's stay above flood. Okay, let's get above flood. Let's get above the insects. Let's get some ventilation underneath our buildings to keep it cooler. And then the way the buildings would open up and let that air conditioning come in. So what I loved about Florida, not dissimilar to what happened in California, a very regional type of architecture, kind of grew up, sort of grassroots, starting in Sarasota, moving over to Miami. There was a real understanding of our climate here. And the mid-century that we get in Florida is very different from the mid-century that we get in California because of our humid and hot climate. And so I found it fascinating. And I thought if there was a way I could reach back into the past to teach us all, architects, everyone, so we could learn together about how we could build better for the future. So
That's your story.
that's part of my story. There's a lot more. I mean, I have some nice slides if you'd like to see them.
Well, if you had, that's perfect example. You can talk about it, but if you have some nice slides of what you're talking about, it'd be great to see them.
I would be happy to share. Okay, I just have to. Okay, so this is what I was talking about. I love this slide about, all of the different things and how we were all affected by mid-century design. And because we're Florida, I kind of feel one of the most iconic symbols that we have in Florida were our motels. I mean, there was so much great design going on in Florida. And it had a lot to do with the various things like the scale of these buildings. They're very human scale. And when I say scale, I'm talking about the human experience with these buildings. So the size of the doors aren't that big. The size of the rooms aren't that big. So when you go inside, you feel comfortable. The proximity of the pool and the buildings, they're all very cozy spaces. I mean, you can see they make for a great kind of social and public space, these old roadside motels. So these are just some great examples of motels up and down the coast of Florida, which I feel is a great example of how mid-century kind of won the hearts and minds of the people at the time. It was sort of forgotten because everything goes out of fashion, right? But I feel now everything is it's coming back because people realize how valuable all the textures and the shapes and the colors were. And they get very nostalgic for this look. And I'm really glad that that's happening. So one of the things that I did as part of my effort to learn about the past, to design for the future, was I did an exhibition in Southwest Florida about mid-century architecture. And these are some of the posters that we created. So we did an exhibition at the History Museum, and we, along with that, we did some walking tours. We did some talks at the museum. We also brought in the fashion. So I knew at the History Museum, just a solo architecture exhibit wasn't going to bring the people in. So we used, the furniture. We had Herman Miller provided all the mid-century furniture for us. We had fashion. I had a fashion expert come in, go to the local Goodwill and find some great like fashion ideas. And so we dotted both of these things around an architectural exhibit. And even on the night of the opening, we brought in some great old cars. So we had like a half a dozen great mid-century cars that some car club brought in for us. And so it was really, really fun thing to do because it truly was about engaging the public in understanding that in Florida, we had great design. We had really good design back in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, and we could do it again. And so, it was kind of a joint effort that we all went on a journey together to look backwards, to look forward. So, okay, go ahead. Anything?
That I think is they're very good examples, particularly the motels. I'm fascinated by mid-century modern motels, and when you think of the how in the 60s, I'm from the Northeast, how people would come to Florida and they would drive to the destination in a stay in a motel near the roadside events. So, there is, I think you're right. I think there is a nostalgia about that, if you were a kid in the 60s, and I think that that nostalgia kind of sticks with us. One last question. I plan to ask this of every one of our people that we're going to, architects that we're going to interview. I want to know what project in your career do you think has been the most impactful to your client or the community that it's located in, and why? What made it impactful?
I think a lot of our houses have become so impactful because we got a lot of press after Hurricane Ian especially. And a lot of that was national press. It wasn't just located in our local paper or on the local news, which it was brought taken up in both of those, but it also made a big impact around the state and then around the country when it was put on like AccuWeather. It went into Forbes. There was a lot of press on that. So I think our residential, for our residential work, I think that's been very impactful. Of our commercial projects, I think it's been a new project that we recently finished called Bay Street Yard. It's a container park on an urban site downtown. And as far as the community, it is unbelievably impactful in the community. And what's important to me is that it's designed of, it's a container park And so it gives you the pieces to work with and to strategize how to place those pieces on an urban site. But it's also in a flood zone in downtown Fort Myers. And so all of the things that we've learned working on the islands has been, translated to working in town, which, before Ian, before the huge surge of Ian and where everywhere up the Caloosahatchee River got surge, I don't think people would have thought about that as much. But I think that's been really interesting to me how we answered all of those questions about flooding in a commercial setting and how you get the people on the ground because it's called Bay Street Yard. It really is about being in a yard on the ground. But yet the containers have to all be raised and then they have to be dry floodproofed to a point where the water can't get in and affect the appliances and the bar equipment and the electricity. And so all of that had to be considered when we did that. And it's just hugely successful, because not only is it containers and a bar, it's got a stage, it's got food trucks in it. And I love the fact that it's a very small, tight site. And so when there's, when it's full, it's just packed and it's wonderful. I mean, it's really brought a whole new level of design and interest about the space that's been created by using an architect to use these containers in a new and different way to create a very enjoyable outdoor space for the entire community. So I would say it's kind of twofold because I'm a very twofold building because we do residential and we do commercial work.
Well,
So
now, if I'm not
Bay Street
mistaken,
is a
you're
wonderful place. We've been there many times. I've had a few drinks with you there. yes.
Thing that I think is
Ah.
fascinating about Bay Street is it was a urban infill site. It was a relic of a property that wasn't being used for anything productive. And
Yeah.
you take containers that are just leftover items and merge them together to create a wonderful place. You made place with that. It's placemaking.
Thank you. And we already have two more in the works now, too. So in two towns north of here. So I'm hopeful that the idea is gonna, really catch on. So that too is part of the impact, I suppose, is that they're gonna be somewhere else, not just in our town. So yeah.
So if I'm not mistaken, Bayside won a design award this year, did it
Yeah,
not?
Bay Street Yard. It did win a design award. Thank you.
It
We're very honored that
did.
we did win an
It did.
award. Yes. That
That's
it was
always
also,
nice.
yeah, it was
It is.
recognized by the architects as well as the public. How's that?
There you go. There you go. I have a quick question. I want to go back to the house that was stood after Ian. So I want to know what it was like to have that conversation with the owner to tell them your house is still standing.
Yeah, it was good. Very emotional. Sorry. As
Yes.
you can
It's
imagine.
like,
And so I don't know why I, as the architect, decided I had to be the one to go out and find out. But we had no causeway, so we had to go out by boat. So we were there within a week out on the island. We went out by boat. I took a few people. I had AccuWeather with me as well. So they came out and filmed it with me. And we all went out on the boat. And I went and looked at those four houses on the beach so that I could report back to all of my clients. And then the next day, I went inland. I went from the other side of the island, the Bayside, and I did some of the inland projects that we're doing. I even, for one of my commercial projects, I went in and I saved like their stock share certificates. Okay. That was like hidden away in some safe that I had to go through this slippery mud. And I realized after 2 days of that, I thought, okay, I'm done. I'm done. This is not really the architect's job. So I don't know why I did it, but I did, and it was obviously gratifying to be able to give them good news. Sure, there was damage, of course there was damage, but your house is standing. And sure enough, I sent all the images off to our structural engineer, and he gave all four houses an A plus in structural. So that was great. Yeah, I felt really good about that. We could do that for our clients. Nice.
We architects, I think I've always said we make friends of our clients and we get involved with their families and with their stories. So our story becomes their story at times.
Well, you know, most of
that, I find that the enjoyable thing about being an architect.
Yeah,
I agree.
I think because we're on the coast too, a lot of our clients weren't around. They had left, right, because of the storm, and they went back to their homes in the north. And so they weren't coming back because there was no causeway. And so they needed someone to go. And so I guess I volunteered myself and my team members to go and do that. So, yeah.
Grace, thank you so much for your time. And it's been a pleasure talking with you as always. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and letting me share some thoughts and ideas about how the value of architecture needs to be something that everyone appreciates, from the youngest to the oldest. And I love that you're doing this podcast with that kind of goal in mind, because it's a very worthwhile cause that architects will have the chance to tell their stories, to talk about what they do and how they reach the public in so many ways.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for being our inaugural guest. Very appropriate. So for our listeners, thank you for listening. I hope you'll stay tuned for the next series of the collaboration between the Foundation and AIA Florida, Architecture and You. So stay tuned. Thank you.